I invite you to turn in your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 1. I would like to begin with verse 13 and read through verse 16. I greet you in the name of Jesus. This morning we'd like to resume the message on the language of clothing. And of course, language is a way to communicate your thoughts, your attitudes, your desires, and we've been looking at how clothing is a way to do that. I do have the handouts that I'd like to hand out. We're going to do that after I read these verses, and today is more of a history lesson, but I want to start with the Bible. And this verse fits right in with what Brother Dale was teaching us. He talks about our calling and looking into things that angels would desire to look into, things that are eternal. And he says, because of this, wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. That's clothing. Tie up your belt. We don't wear the lunga. We don't wear the Eastern attire. But when they want to go to work, they would gird up their loins. Be sober and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. We're not nearly where we are expecting to be someday. And then in verse 14, as obedient children, not fashioning, schematizo, something like that, not putting yourself into a form according to the former lust in your ignorance, but as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. This morning, we would like to think of one area of liberty, and that is choosing godliness. I never thought about this until Raymond High and I were sent down to Texas, and we met with people who were trying to find their way in church life. And a couple who had come from the world described to us how much freedom there was in wearing godly clothing. She said that she was in the bondage of fashion, where she constantly had to buy new clothes so she could fit in with the new season of fashion that was in style. And it wasn't long until she was out of style again, and you just weren't allowed to be out of style. And she said, when I began to dress in a way that was godly, I was out of style all the time and I was in the right fashion all the time. It just took care of it. Didn't have to worry about that. And it kind of opened my eyes, because I always thought that we were in some kind of bondage, having to dress about the same all the time. And it isn't a bondage, it's a liberty. And the same way it is with so many things in the Christian life, the more you feed sin, the more it grows on you. I was impressed in my devotions in reading about Jesus turning the water into wine. And the man said, you know what, we always get the best first and then it gets worse. And that's the way it is in the world. You always get the best first and then it gets worse. But he says, you brought us the best last, and that's the way it is for us. We have so much to look forward to in spite of the decisions and difficulties that we have today. We have so much to look forward to. Now, I have two flyers today. Maybe next time I'll have three handouts. Last Sunday, I sort of went a little different direction. It's the first column on the inside of this page. And so I printed out a review of what I had on the board. If you were not here last Sunday, if you were here last Sunday and you have this already, then just take this. But if you were not here last Sunday and you'd like to have the whole handout, then these papers are inside of here, okay? So if you were here and brought your handout along, then Brother Dale, can I get you to pass these out? Raise your hand when Brother Dale comes along and take that. If you were not here, or if you did not bring your flyer along, Loyal, can I get you to hand these out? Thank you. Then that's you'll want the whole thing if you were not here or if you forgot to bring your handout, because I do intend to follow that a little more closely as we look at the history. Now, I'm quite worried about this sermon today because of the fact that it's so scatterbrained. But I've been praying about it. I'm just going to trust the Lord to lead us through this as we go through this, because I have my own journey. But not only that, we have the journey of history. And not only the journey of history, but it needs to all somehow make sense whenever the whole story of clothing and fashion doesn't make any sense at all anyway. I brought a book along with me, a book that we've come to enjoy. It's called Mennonite Attire Through 4 Centuries, 400 years. It's written in 1970, printed in 1970, so it's not that old, but it gives you the story, and the more you read the story of how shoes changed, or how hats changed, or how facial wear changed, or whatever it is, the more you just look at it and shake your head and say, what a mess. Well, I shouldn't say what a mess, but it's so very interesting as Christians try to respond to the pressure of clothing and style and fashion through the years. Okay, I have plenty today. I didn't make the same mistake as I did last time, so I have plenty. If you need an extra handout, help yourself to that. So I'm going to refer to this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reading, although I would like to, but I know that is very boring unless you're the one doing the reading and talking about it. But if any of you want to look at this or get more documentation, I will be talking about it somewhat. Now, as we come to the handout that I think Brother Dale's just giving you, the one that we had last time, I would like to read this in unison just as a review for you, because these truths are simple and they are timeless. The principles are simple. Now, how to apply it can get rather complicated, and I don't want to make it sound worse than it is, but I think it can get rather complicated as you compare one group of people to another, and you see some who obviously succeeded and some who did not in applying these principles. So from the little paper that says what God wants a Christian's clothes to say, I would like to say number one, and then we're going to read that one together, okay? What God wants a Christian's clothes to say. Got it? Had enough of those? You want one of those? Okay, help yourself. All right, number one. I keep my body covered and I live a pure life. Can you say that with your clothes? Can you say, I uncover my body and I live carelessly? Of course you can. Now, how you live can say the opposite. We talked about that last week. Seems like a year ago. But last week, we talked about how you can say something at the same time you give a body expression that says you don't believe that. You're saying the exact opposite. All right, number two is from Numbers 15. Together, I remind myself that I am in a covenant with God. Now, this one I kind of minimize because we don't wear the fringe. We're not in the Old Testament. But what is an abomination to God? Deuteronomy 22 is still an abomination. And so number three, I identify with my God-given gender. Now that may vary. They wore more of a skirt-type garment. In the Old Testament, it wasn't a lot of difference between the male and the females, the skirt-type clothing. We wear something very different, but our society needs to be able to read that God made me a man, I'm a man, God made me a woman. Or if God would have made me a woman, I would be a woman. Number four, from Matthew 6, Jesus' teaching, I will not obsess over my clothing. It's not a big deal to me. There are other things that are important. And then 1 Timothy 2:9, which is a confrontation of our culture today, I use a neat and orderly appearance to show I am an overcomer in the battle of life. You didn't know, I didn't write all that up on the board, but that's basically what I'm saying, and I have more story to go along with that. And then number six, 1 Peter 3, it's not 3:3, together, my glory is on the inside, not in outward adornment or ornaments. Okay, thank you. The same way with the next reference. It's just verse 2, not 22. Romans chapter 12, verse 2, together, I listen on heaven's directives, not on this world's styles or fashions. And then, the same way in the next verse, I really messed up all of those. It's 1 Peter 5:5, number 8, together. I see myself as a servant to others. And then finally, number 9, from Revelation 16:15, my focus is eternity and Christ's heavenly kingdom. Thank you very much for that. I trust that those principles will guide us as we go through this discussion. Now, let's talk about history. I don't have a lot of Bible verses for the rest of the morning, but I'd like to talk about what happened when common, ordinary people got a printed Bible in their hands. For hundreds of years, the common, ordinary people could not read. But when Gutenberg invented the printing press, and he began to print Bibles, just print them again and again, and the common ordinary people got Bibles in their hands, and they started reading these things. They said, the church isn't telling us what the Bible says. It's taking things and twisting it out of proportion. This is God's word. This is how God wants us to live. And they stopped baptizing babies, which was the thing that got the focus, but the rest of their lives changed drastically as well. And one of the things that got affected was their dress. And so what I'd like to talk about is how did people apply this in the early days of the Anabaptist movement? And that's something you find in reference books like this, and they're very consistent. Now, what I'd like to say about the columns, and I'm on the inside of the larger flyer here, if there are quotation marks, I took this word for word from some printed source. It may have come from an online source, but it probably came mostly from books like this, and I didn't bring my big ones along. This is a nice little one, but there are big books that talk about this history. And the first thing that we'd like to notice is that many, though not all, of the early Anabaptists were drawn from the common people and evidently continued to wear the conventional clothing of the common people. There is no evidence to show that the early Anabaptists created any uniform garb for the members of the church. The ladies wore dresses to their ankles and sleeves way past their elbows, and the men dressed modestly. Their pants only went to their knees, but their stockings went the rest of the way down. And if you look at the garb of that day, basically all the preachers had to say is dress like everybody else. Just don't wear stuff that the Bible forbids. Don't wear gold. Don't wear jewelry. Don't wear lace. Don't wear silks. Don't wear things that would show that you are wealthy. Today we tell people what to wear in order to dress simply. And back then, they told them what not to wear. And that's one of the biggest differences if you study history. Now, in the course of time, the second quote here is, the Anabaptists became recognizable at sight by their refusal to carry any kind of arms and by their plainness of dress. No jewelry, lace, etc. were worn. This plainness tended to develop into a sort of standard garb. For as new modes of dress appeared, the Anabaptists clung to the older forms, sometimes adapting them over the years and refusing to keep up with ever-changing styles. We find a lot of documentation on that, and I find it interesting. One of the things that I found so interesting was what Menno Simons wrote. They say that they believe, and yet, alas, there are no limits nor bounds to their accursed haughtiness, foolish pride and pomp. They parade in silks, velvet, costly clothes, gold rings, chains, silver belts, pins and buttons, curiously adorned shirts, shawls, collars, veil, aprons, velvet shoes, slippers, and such like foolish finery. Oh, I thought they didn't have the money for that kind of thing. Well, there are always wealthy people who were able to have more, and that brought in another whole issue of sumptuary laws. The other quote that I'll read is at the bottom here. The Strasbourg Discipline of 1568, the Anabaptist movement started in 1525, and so you're about this many years later, included the following. Tailors And seamstresses shall hold to the plain and simple style and shall make nothing at all for pride's sake. Brethren and sisters shall stay by the present form of our regulation concerning apparel and make nothing for pride's sake. And I could read many other quotes in relation to that. In keeping with headship teaching of 1 Corinthians 11, women wore head coverings and men only covered for weather. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot about the hats because they were prominent experience. The men's hats were prominent for many, many years because they lived in the weather. They didn't go to church in the weather. I mean, they went to church. They didn't go to church in carriages or didn't go to church in cars. And so they did wear hats, but they were careful not to wear them as a sign of religion. This existed for many years, although a historical fact happened that I only refer to under Mennonite applications. So I would like to jump over to that while I'm here, jumping over the Industrial Revolution and Honor, Dignity, Culture columns and go to Mennonite applications, where some Anabaptist groups chose to maintain the peasant costume of their native country, Amish and Hutterite. Now, I don't have the history on the Hutterites, but the history on the Amish is very interesting because Jacob Ammon chose something that other Anabaptist leaders had never chosen, and it made a reaction. There is a writer who was from Holland at that time who wrote very popular catechisms that went through many editions and are still being read by the Amish today, but he wrote his feelings about what Jacob Ammon did, and this is what he wrote. I am sincerely grieved that you have been so disturbed by those who think highly of themselves and make laws of things which are not upheld in the gospel. Had it been specified in the apostolic letters how or wherewith a believer should be clothed, or whether he should go in this or that country, and this were disobeyed, then these had something of which to speak. But it is more contrary to the gospel to affix one's conscience to a pattern of the hats, clothes, stockings, shoes, or the hair of the head, or make a distinction in which country one lives. He goes on down to talk about Colossians 2 and how that applies. Wherefore then does our friend Jacob Ammon undertake to make such laws of such things for the people and to expel from the church those who will not obey him? This doesn't sound like a Mennonite writer, does he? But Jacob Ammon started to discipline. You had to wear a certain costume and live in a certain place or you would get disciplined. And that was not the norm for the normal Mennonite or Anabaptist church leader. If he considers himself a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ and advocates a literal administration of the law, then he must not wear two coats nor carry money in his purse or shoes on his feet. If he does not adhere to the letter of his Lord, how dare he insist on obedience from his fellow man in regulations that he has not received from his lawmaker? Oh, that he might do as the Apostle Paul had done. And he goes on to say so forth. But he brings more in this. In all of Paul's letters, we do not find one word in which he has given believers regulations concerning the forms of clothing they should have, but in all things he instructed them to condescend to men of low estates. He goes on to quote more. According to all decency and modesty, I hold that it is becoming to adapt the manner of dress to the current customs of one's environments. But it is reasonable that we abstain from luxuries, pride, and carnal worldly lust, not immediately adopting the latest styles of fashionable clothing, which is certainly something to be reproved. But when it has come into common usage, then it is honorable to follow in such common apparel and to walk in humility. So there you see defined the difference between the Mennonite heritage and the Amish heritage, because he spelled out, Jacob Ammon spelled out a particular costume that they were supposed to keep. Now what they have today is in the descendants of that. It's the lineage of that, even though there's no way you can keep the exact same from generation to generation. But the Mennonites said, no, you fit in with your society that you are, but then you don't cross barriers that would violate scriptures. Well, that all got a challenge later on, because the next thing we need to talk about is the Industrial Revolution. Now, there's a lot more quotes that I can read for that, and I'm not sure how much to read this morning. But the Industrial Revolution brought its biggest change in clothing, the biggest one that it affected the lives, because people no longer spent so much time of their time making their clothing, and they spent more time in earning money and spending their money on clothing in other ways. And I will read some more quotes from what I have there if I happen to be able to find them. And if I don't, it's okay too. Before the Industrial Revolution, just spinning the yarn for a change of clothing required about 2 years of work. That does not include the laborious process of harvesting and preparing the plant fibers, nor does it include weaving on looms powered entirely by the weaver's muscles. And so you'll find that basically, well, I really would like to find this, because what I have to say is stunning. Here it is. And this comes from an article from the internet. Before the Industrial Revolution of the 1700s, fashion used to be slow. Clothes were made at home and in small fashion houses. The sourcing of materials, fabric weaving, garment cutting, and sewing took a lot of time and effort. Many people created their clothes in small quantities and wore them for a very long time. Each garment was repaired many times over before its fabric scraps would be reused to make new clothes. They were patched, resized, remade, and handed down until there was nothing left to use. People owned only a few different outfits and would get by with only these. Fashion wasn't a prominent industry like it is today. Clothing production wasn't a viable business model, as it took a long time to make new clothes. People simply made their clothing on their own, mainly from natural and organic materials such as cotton, linen, hemp, rayon, or jute. Clothes were very heavy and hard to wash, and some women couldn't leave their house because of how much their clothes weighed. Can you imagine? But in the late 1700s, people used to dress about the same depending on their social classes. Almost every woman owned a sewing machine and knew how to use it. They often created beautiful, one-of-a-kind fabric garments that could last for decades. But then the classes emerged, because some people could afford it and other people couldn't. So there were three classes. Upper-class men wore three-piece suits with long socks and top hats, while women wore fancy dresses with hoops, wires, and stays. They had access to luxurious imported fabrics, intricate adornments, and the labor of skilled artisans. Now, when it first came, the people who were wealthy got more than the others, but after a while, everybody could do this. The middle class owned a couple of outfits that vary according to the occasion, from scrub to fancy. The lower class generally wore the same clothes for a long time and didn't have the means to repair them, resulting in worn-out clothing and few colors. And James talks about that. We're going to study how that the rich man comes in these fancy clothes and you give him a high degree, and the poor man comes and you say, sit here in the corner, because it is so easy to tell how much money they have. Well, the Industrial Revolution came along. Oh, I wanted to comment on the countries had sumptuary laws, laws that forbade people from wearing clothing beyond their class, especially applied to Jews. A lot of the Jews had more money and they could buy clothing that put them beyond their class. And people would wear that because they liked to show off. And the men did first. First, the men were, well, you know what it's like in the pictures of the American Revolutionary Fathers, and how they had their wigs and their silks and their clothing. It was just awesome when you look at that. They wanted to show their wealth by how much they had. The largest Industrial Revolution change on the clothing industry was that people became more fashion conscious and began purchasing clothing for style rather than necessity. Before the revolution, people crafted their own clothes and had just enough to get by. And then people started to express themselves through clothing by wearing accessories, scarves, hats, or even with unusual colors and patterns. They asked for new trends at an affordable price in the late 1960s, fashion became a way of self-expression to communicate one's personality and creativity. So the Industrial Revolution made our lives a lot more simple, but it made church life a lot more complicated because all of a sudden, people could buy a closet full of clothes. How many changes of clothing do you have? How many everyday changes? How many Sunday changes do we have? Because the Bible talks about, and when it talks about us not wearing many clothing, there are references in the Bible about not having an abundance of clothing. But today it's a totally different feel than it was then, because a lot of times we buy our clothing secondhand, at least the men can. One of the articles that I had is how to avoid fast fashion and build a wardrobe that lasts. Our issues with fast fashion are similar to the trouble with fast food. It's low quality, it's bad for you, and it's harmful to the environment. Think of it like a dollar menu burger. That burger will save you money now, but it will cost you in the long run because of the toll it takes on your health. Similarly, that $15 shirt may be a cheaper option now, but it will cost you by wearing out sooner, which increases the number of shirts you have to buy in a lifetime, okay? According to the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, over 5% or 17 million tons of the municipal solid waste in landfills comes from textile waste each year. The main source of textile waste in our landfills is discarded clothing. And this only accounts for post-consumer textile waste. Garment factories produce millions of tons of textile waste annually when making new clothes, and the fashion industry produces 10% of all greenhouse gas emissions each year, according to the BBC. Okay, what's that all say? Well, if you're climate conscious, you should have just a few clothes, is what the article is saying, trying to say, buy better clothes, fewer clothes, and wear them out, or else buy somebody else's clothes at a reuse-it shop. To save the environment. It's interesting, the perspective that they came from. But what I'm trying to show you is that things really changed around the time of the Civil War and thereafter. It came to America and it came into the Mennonite Church. And if you look at the pictures of the people in those eras of time, you can see that the Mennonites especially were really challenged, not as much as the Amish, because they stayed by the garb that they basically had. They had the huge challenge of knowing whether to go to factory woven material or to stay with their homespun, but that didn't take too long till they switched as well, because it was so much cheaper and even lasted better than what they could make themselves. Now, all of a sudden, all of this abundance of clothing came into a culture that is very different than ours. I want to talk a little bit now about the honor dignity culture. And as it affects clothing, it affected a lot more. But in America, before the law could reach out, people protected themselves by the honor culture. If you offended me, I was supposed to get even. I would challenge you to a duel. We'd go out and trade shots, and whoever was the fastest with the gun would survive, and the other one was killed. The cultures, and this is my own words, the cultures 18th and 19th century in the West were cultures of honor and transitioned in the 20th century to dignity. That's the early 1900s. Honor was something that had to be earned and protected. The dignity culture assumed that all humans have dignity that does not have to be earned or personally defended. It was beneath dignity to be a victim. Now, back in the day, before I was born, if you were insulted, you would react and demand that you were given your honor that you deserved. But in the day when I grew up, this was in the South, and I think it was in the North as well, and more of the Mennonite societies, and that was that you had dignity, and you would not get offended over anything. You did not, if you were abused as a child, or if you were taken advantage of, you just stuffed it in. And you just lived it out. You just overcame it. You didn't act it out. But Whenever the Industrial Revolution came along, clothing reflected the intention of both men and women in their desire to be respected and honored, display wealth and class even above what may have actually existed. As clothing became more available, the pursuit of fashion and styles was relentless. Ladies chose all manner of jewelry and makeup, honoring the prevailing fashion of the day. Hairstyles changed, seeking to highlight femininity for women and classic styles for men. Everyday clothing may have been comfortable, but fashionable clothing was not, and generational differences were minimized. In other words, that is an important part of this, but you didn't have a generation gap between the young and the old. But when styles came along, people would try to dress up as much as they could. So the early Mennonite church standards finally came to a place where the Mennonites said, we can't just say, don't wear things. We have to tell them what they can wear. And it was about the turn of the 1900s, the best that I can tell. I couldn't find the first church rule that said our women will wear cape dresses and the men will wear plain suits and we will dress up. But the whole goal was to look with dignity, but not with decoration and not display wealth. And they were trying to find the answer for the highfalutin dress up of the people around them, because that was very real. If you look in the books, you can see. And a lot of times the ladies would dress up, or the men too, until they were baptized. And all of a sudden they would come with hats and all kind of ribbons and lace and finery and all kinds of things. It was always modest because they were still dressing down to their feet, the ladies were, and I didn't see anything really immodest. But you dressed as fine as you could because you were able to now. You could. But as soon as they were baptized, they got into their hats and their bonnets, and the cape dresses, and suddenly looked very, very plain because the church said so. That's what you had to do in order to do that. Well, let's look at this. Some Anabaptist groups, I already read that. Let's jump down. Other Anabaptists, such as Mennonites and Brethren, allowed members to wear clothing of their new culture with respect to Bible principles. This is history now. Before the Industrial Revolution, written standards on dress were unnecessary. But after the Industrial Revolution, resolutions to maintain principles without standards were ignored. Preachers preached themselves blue in the face and said, you shouldn't dress up, you shouldn't be fancy, you should be plain and simple and not wear ornamentation, and the people did whatever they wanted to do until they came to a dividing point. Standards were pushed to the limit and needed to become more explicit. Churches that gave up on standards acculturated and adopted many unbiblical practices, but conservative conferences established standards in an effort to maintain modesty, respect, and nonconformity to fads and fashions. Now, I'll just say that the people from Russian Mennonite background that lived in colonies did not feel this as much as people who came from Central Europe and lived in communities. Even the larger communities were not as affected as the ones that were in the West. Now, the West adopted the plain suit and some of the types of clothing that we wear a little quicker than Pennsylvania did. It was slower. Pennsylvania did not have the same. If you look, it's interesting that the plain suit and even some of the cape dress type of arrangement that we have seems to have come from the West and came East. But then those were the cultures that also gave it up the soonest. Now we can come to my lifetime, because up until this point, basically the generations dressed about the same. Fashion only affected them a little, and the church tried to take a stand against wearing extras and immodest clothing. But then came the rebellion culture. It's interesting to pick up the storybook or the readers from the 1940s. Alice and Jerry, or Dick, Jane, and Sally. Those storybooks where they taught children to read in public schools, taught values, and the children were dressed. Basically, the little girls had dresses and the boys had pants. Now they got a little, as the further it went, they got shorter and changed some, but there was not the difference between generations. I went to public school. I was born and raised in Pensacola, Florida, And I went to public school from first grade through the 10th grade. When I was in the fourth grade, and I talked to a friend of mine that was in the same grade, and we both remembered the same event. Now, another Eddie Tisdale didn't remember that, but we both remembered when four girls stood up in the show and tell time and tried to sing and act like the Beatles. And just the way they sang and the way they shook themselves, television had just come out in our culture down there in the 60s, and they could see them, and the way they copied them made all the boys cross. They booed because we didn't look that way and we didn't act that way. The Beatles musical group illustrated and energized a generation that no longer wished to be guided by honor and dignity. And these are some quotes now that I got. The Beatles reoriented American music, helped the country shake off the drab conformity of mid-century consensus, and in the process even provoked one of the first major battles of the modern culture wars. They led the way in production and album-oriented rock. They pioneered music videos. They also transformed attitudes about mind-altering drugs and ushered in new interest in non-Western or the Eastern, the Oriental religions. They introduced the concept of generational gap into America and made the change the norm. Western society made drastic changes reflected in dress changes, shaggy hairstyles, unisex clothing, miniskirts, bell-bottom trousers, and feminine shirts, a visible challenge to the moral values of the older established society. That happened in my lifetime, because from the time that I was in the fourth grade till I was in the seventh grade, and went off to a middle school, it was a junior high school back in those days, I remember the drastic change in the group of people that I was with. I combed my hair again this way this morning just so I would look like I did when I was in the first, second, third, and fourth grades. I usually comb it about this way anyway, but I made sure that I've got it here so it's not falling down on my face. When I went to the seventh grade, I had to wear this same kind of a haircut. My parents weren't going to do anything different. But I didn't like it. And when I got to school, I wanted to look like the rest of the boys. There was only two of us that had short hair, and there's about 150 in our class, so there's about 75 boys. And there was only two of us that had short hair, tapered haircuts. But if I look at the pictures of the days, I am ashamed. I was already a church member. I had become a church member when I was in sixth grade. But by the time I was in seventh grade, and I was the only Mennonite boy in that whole class, I was the only one in gym class that had to wear long pants. I was the only one that had to stick out, even tried to pray at time to eat lunch and get out my lunch with its homemade bread and those kind of things, and nobody else had anything like that. So at least I could comb my hair down in my face as far as I could. So I combed it down and pulled it over seventh and eighth grades. And I look back at those days and I'm like, the language of clothing, because I was trying to tell my friends that I wanted to fit in with them. That's what I was trying to do. But at the same time, I was trying to be a good church member, or at least not even get in trouble with the church. I don't even remember being scolded by my parents. But I don't know if they knew everything until they saw the pictures, of course, and would have known then what was going on. Well, this rebellion culture introduced generation gap, and there became a big generation. Kenneth Hazlett was a young man who became a Christian, and he accepted our values. He was 2 years older than me, and he came to church. He was baptized. He was a faithful member, until he came north and heard the liberal Mennonite preachers talk to him about how conservative churches are like the people. They had the parable of the stones. And the people that were under this would take stones in bags and hang them around their necks and walk, carry them around in their work. And the ones who wanted to be stronger would have bigger stones, and the ones who wanted to be more accepted would wear smaller stones around their neck. And finally one day they realized, why are they even doing these things? It doesn't make them stronger. And so they threw their stones away. And this was to represent plain clothes. Conservative Lancaster Conference was telling the young people people who came from non-Mennonite background to get rid of their plain clothes was what it was. I don't know why Kenneth dropped it, but the first I saw was when I sat in church and I looked up at him, I was sitting beside him and I looked at him and I saw that his sideburns were down to the bottom of his ear and they never had been before. And then I never saw him in church again after that. Why? What happened? It didn't take him long until he was wearing all of these things that are a challenge there. And I realized then that I could not keep going that way. By the time I got to the 10th grade, my own story was, there was a young man there who carried a Bible around on the top of his books. And I said, that's what I need. So I got the Bible and put it in my pocket. And then I didn't have any trouble combing my hair right. I didn't have any trouble talking right. I didn't have any trouble acting right. Because I identified as a Christian and I wasn't going to do the things that the rest of society wore. Well, there's a lot more that I could be saying about that, but this is not about me. The fact of the matter is in my lifetime, it was one set of challenges, but today it's another set. Today we live, and I'm going to the column on victim culture now. We live in an era sometimes described as a culture of victimhood. And this is I'm not making this up, because honor and dignity, you can find that. Rebellion, I did make that up because Beatles had a song that they called Revolution. And it's pretty obvious, but the victimhood culture is very much around today. No longer does being slighted or shamed cause one to challenge to a duel or lead one to ignore any put down. Rather, people feel free to advertise their slights through social media or even in lawsuits before the courts of the land. This culture is expressed in the language of dress. And today, the more you can look like you've been abused and misused and taken advantage of, but the problem is you can only go so far. And after a while, when everybody looks that way, you don't stand out as being made, taken advantage of more than anyone else. But everybody wants to tell the biggest sob story. It's no longer a dishonor to go to court and spill all the beans of your family. You can go to court and say every bad thing that anything everybody else has done, and even some more that you've imagined. And if you can tell a worse story, then you're more honored than anybody else is. I mean, you've found more favor. No longer is grunge used to describe the gunk found in your plumbing. And this I found, documentation on this. Now it describes popular music and the clothing worn by popular groups. And I thought I was really saying it modern until I realized that they said that the grunge music was from the 1990s. And that's already 30 years old. Where does time go? Time changes so fast. Clothing, even when new, may be torn, faded, or look otherwise abused. I found out where that comes from, the torn jeans and the washed out jeans. And you go to Bangladesh and you see the ladies bending over their fountains and stones and just tearing into the brand new jeans and trying to tear them up and make them look jagged even though they're brand new so they can sell them at clothing stores. Tattoos are popular, supposedly designed to express the real person inside. Now they've just found out that most of those inks cause cancer. Then what? Multiple piercings beyond the traditional earrings are prominent. Yes, I even thought that last night when I went in. Yes, you just see it everywhere. Pins all over the place. Rings stuck in their lips and nose and ears and everywhere. Hair is cut in very strange manners and dyed in strange arrangements. Shaven, bald, or seriously overgrown is accepted. Brother Dale was talking about a man who shaved the top of his head and left all of his beard grow. Because he wants to look that way. That's what he looks like. Used to be if your hair fell out because you were getting bald, that was kind of looked down on, right? I guess it's an honor now, Brother Cliff. It's just an honor to be bald. Disheveled in appearance is normal and showing this clash of culture. Well, this morning, what are we going to do? A generation before me, I am glad that my own story wasn't just told in public school. As a young man growing up, my father was concerned about the changes that were coming into our church. We would go to Dave Wilkerson Crusades and see the other Mennonite young people, and they wouldn't be having coverings on. They would wear a bandana that matched their dress. But they still had their heads covered. We would see them in other events, and they laid aside their cape dresses and began to wear skirts and blouse, but it was still very modest. At least it was supposed to be, but then maybe it wasn't quite as much. And so these changes came in, and what were we going to do? And my father said, we're going to take a different course. And I remember when the leaders of the conference came and ridiculed him and said that he would never keep the hearts of his children if he decided that he was going to take a different course in church life. And yet, as I look back today, I'm so grateful that he did. And I'm not saying that it was perfect then, because there's always this balance. But when I realized that a church that spoke to the issue of clothing would also speak to the issue of drugs, one of my memories is to go and visit the bishop who baptized me. I asked if I could go along with my father and mother because I wanted to see him again. We had already left the church, and I was probably 17 years of age by that time. And we went up to see this bishop and his wife. And I pled with him. I opened my mouth. And in the process, I said, yes, we still have struggles and temptations too, but we're not struggling with things like drugs and divorce and remarriage or fornication before marriage and all of those things. And he said, so what are your struggles? And I realized that what he wanted to do was sidetrack the discussion and avoid the issue. I didn't talk any further about him, but I've had him. We all will have struggles. But as I watched his family grow up and go away from there, and my own relatives, and you can see that as well, I'm come convinced that a church that can no longer address the moral issue of dress can't address the moral issue of anything. And so today the church is splitting again and again over things like women preachers or LGBT agenda or one thing after another, because after all, God loves all sinners and he forgives them all. Christian clothing. There will always be a people who are separated from the world unto God. For them, for the same Bible standards that guided God's people through the ages still applies. Clothing will send signals of a people that are not pressed into the world's way of thinking. Care will be taken to cover the body in the same manner that God clothed our first parents. Opaque materials, not form-fitting, and covering the limbs. The victim culture will be denied and confronted by orderliness and good grooming. You know, this is probably one that hits our young people. You know, if you tear your hair or you dishevel the way your hair is combed, or if you want to wear the streaky jeans, or you want to wear the even skin-tight trousers, This is going along with society and denying Bible principles. The victim culture will be denied. The body will be kept free from any stray markings and piercings. Gender principles will be honored as men wear masculine clothing and women wear that which pertains to women. Since God has planned an overlap of generations and that we submit one to another in the fear of the Lord, the generations will be sensitive to and honor older generational values. Now, I forgot to read the outside of here, but you can see some of the parallel descriptions that are on the outside. Where will we stand? We know that true godliness begins in the heart. Godliness is not just something that is put on the outside, and there's these two balances. People that become so obsessed with the outward appearance, and that's all they can talk about. I think there was a whole generation got disgusted with that, because in my reading, I found out in history that in a certain period of time, there were like dozens and dozens of articles that were on uniformity and nonconformity in appearance. And after a while, people just get this glazed look on their face about, they get tired of that. But on the other hand, then we quit preaching about it. When is the last time you heard a sermon on nonconformity of attire? Well, we kind of realize it's unpopular, so we steer away from it. But the Bible principles rule, and that we need to accept the generational values of the older one, because we too will be old someday, and for me a little sooner than a lot of you. But the older ones faced the pressures of the dignity culture and dressed down, but we're facing a different pressure. We need to learn from those who did away with distinctive attire and who accepted worldly values in other areas as well. And as we learn from them, we need to go choose a way of holiness. I could talk a little while about the clash that came in our own midst. I think I'll admit that this morning, if I may get away with it. In the last few years, there has been a voice that said that men should wear facial hair because it's a creation principle. The generation that was raised in the dignity culture said, absolutely not. It stands for the grunge look, it stands for dirt and for filth. It should not be allowed. And both of them spoke from the perspective that they believed was right. But we cannot confront creation principles. But what I will say is that the church has decided that we will not allow those symbols of fashion or worldliness, like long sideburns, goatees, donut beards, you know, the adapting and changing them so you look like I'm cool and I fit in with, or even a shaved head and a long beard. We won't allow that either. You know, they're just different ways that you can tell the culture that I fit in with you. We also need to beware of the generational gap and stair-step apostasy. We need to respect the biblical attire of other church groups. We are not the only ones trying to find our way with this. As we work together, we respect other groups that have different choices that are working their way through these choices as well. But let's be careful that we beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. It is so easy to try to cover up a wicked heart with conservative clothing. And that is a real snare that exists as well. I better stop. Time's up. I think I've about run out to say we could talk a little bit about how fashion is driven today. It's driven by a desire for money. It used to come from Paris. Now it's driven by celebrities. And I'm concerned about the influence that we have, even in following the news today, and how it brings us right in touch with what's going on in the world. Is that where we're going to go? Are we going to follow them into hell? Or will we take a stand and keep on reading our Bibles and allow it to influence us? Thank you for listening, and God bless you. Back to 1 Peter, I'm just going to read this again. Gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lust in your ignorance, but as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. God bless you in this pursuit. Let's kneel for prayer.